I think people are still coming in, but in the interests of time, because it's a very full day in South Kensington, as will become apparent later, very full day for entomologists anyway, I'm going to sort of kick off with my little introductory spiel. So, a very warm welcome to you all to this year's Frederick W. Edwards Lecture in Insect Natural History. This annual event is now in its third year and still evolving. However, it remains true, and I hope it will always remain true, to its original objectives, which are threefold. First, to celebrate annually through honouring and remembering Fred Edwards, arguably the greatest scientist ever employed in the 90-odd year history of the museum's entomology department, to, say, celebrate our work on insect biosystematics, taxonomy and natural history here in South Kensington. Secondly, to provide a high point for our annual series of internal talks and seminars on insect natural history, whereby we invite a distinguished scientist to share with us their particular insights into insect biology and natural history. Our choice of speaker is linked not only to their eminence, however, we also seek to invite those who are or wish to be closely involved in some way with the work of the department. The third is to reconfirm and reinvigorate our long-standing links with the Royal Entomological Society. Now, for the first 2 years, this has not really worked very well. But today we're trying an experiment, which we hope will be the basis of a blueprint for the future. Such meetings, which we would anticipate normally to be held at this time of the year, the first Wednesday of each June. We have retimed the lecture somewhat, and the Society has retimed its all-important council meeting in the search of greater togetherness. We'll say a little bit more about further entomological events that will be happening today after our honoured guest has delivered this year's lecture. And turning to our honoured guest, it's my delight and privilege to welcome Charles Godfrey as this year's Edwards Lecturer. Charles has an enormous number of achievements to his credit, but today I'm just going to mention three. First and foremost, Charles is an extraordinary combination of true entomologist, modern biological scientist, and natural historian. I can think literally of very few others who have such talents all in abundance. Second, I remind you that he's not only Professor of Evolutionary Biology at Imperial College, as a fellow of the Royal Society. Now, in the context of South Kensington and our special relationship with Imperial College and Frederick Edwards, this all has great significance. Edwards was the only scientist to spend his entire entomological career in our entomology department who was elected to the Royal Society. Now, that's history. Charles is very much of the present, and even more, I'm sure, of the future for entomology in South Kensington, on which he will have an increasing and ever more significant impact, I am sure. So it's with the greatest possible pleasure that I introduce Charles Godfrey as the 2001 Frederick W. Edwards Lecturer in Insect Natural History. Charles.
Thank you, Dick, for that very kind lecture, and I'd like for that very kind introduction. And I'd like to start off slightly more felicitously, I hope, by saying what a thrill it is to be talking at the Natural History Museum. Like many of you, I suspect, one of the high points of my childhood was I grew up largely in Bristol, and the annual trip with my father and brother up to the Natural History Museum was a real high point, where as a young lepidopterist we'd try and identify our moths with, and again, I think they've gone now, but many of you will remember the moths that were on the on display, the whole collection of British Lepidoptera, which had been up so long that they were all a sort of uniform colour of straw, and is a generation of very good naturalists who could manage to identify their moths from that. I've called my lecture Darwin's Nightmare, What Parasitoid Wasps Can Tell Us About Ecology and Evolution, because Darwin found something very special about... I'm sorry, I think that was the screensaver kicking in. something very special about Paris that it was. One of the great things about the internet is now the Origin of Species is up on the web, and one can very easily create one's own concordance. One can go through and see when Darwin mentioned various things. And he mentioned the Paris that it was, he called them ichneumons, a general name for all of them in those days, about four or five times. And in each case, he mentioned them as something really quite horrific. When he wanted to find something horrible about the natural world, he would pick on ichneumons. And this was well expressed in a letter to the American naturalist, Asa Gray, when he said, "I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God could have designedly created the ichneumonidae with their express intention of their feeding within the larval, within the living bodies of caterpillars." He really found this a horrible idea. And parasitoids, I'm afraid, revolted Darwin. Now, I'm lecturing partly to you, but I'm also, I hope, lecturing partly to Darwin's shade. I would like to try and convince him that he was wrong, that there are some wonderful things about parasitoids, and that these illuminate to a great extent the theory of which he was the origin, and also the subject of which of ecology, of which he was also one of the founding fathers. And so what I want to do in this talk is several things. I want to try and persuade you that parasitoids, parasitic wasps, are just absolutely fascinating insects. I want to try and persuade you that they're great models for trying to understand some of the outstanding problems in ecology and evolution. And finally, I want to try and persuade you is that we can better understand these outstanding problems in pure science by an amalgam of our natural history understanding, looking at the systematics, their ecology, by merging pure science with natural history. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start off very briefly by introducing parasitoids, which I know they'll be very familiar to most of you. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through a series of vignettes of what I consider to be interesting work that's currently being done on parasitoid wasps. This will be a very non-random selection of vignettes, very much betraying my own personal interest in the subject and people that I've worked with. And someone else giving this talk would choose different subjects. But I hope they will illuminate those three goals of the talk. So what is a parasitoid? Well, a parasitoid is an insect whose larvae develop in or on the bodies of other insects. Or occasionally other arthropods. The larvae only need a single host to complete their development. So they're sort of, in a sense, midway between parasites, which only need one host, and predators, which need many. And they invariably kill the insect upon which they feed. What I've also put there is parasitoids, at least how I define them, is they don't move the host to a prepared nest or cache. So I distinguish parasitoids from some of the solitary wasps, which in other ways have a very similar life cycle, except they build a burrow in the ground or a nest in which they move the host that they've got. Now, parasitoids, as generally understood, are insects, and I'm going to be concentrating today almost completely on parasitoid wasps, members of the family Hymenoptera. Some people widen the term parasitoid to anything with a life cycle that needs a single host which it invariably kills. And people who do that are making interesting points about trophic relationships, but I think it's less confusing just to restrict it to insects. So as I say, parasitoid wasps are Hymenoptera, and let me just fit them in within the Hymenoptera. It's a bit dangerous coming with a phylogeny or cladogram to the Natural History Museum, and I thought there were really two strategies. One was to have one that was really state-of-the-art with bootstraps and everything like that, or another one that was such a cartoon and caricature that no one would take it seriously, and I thought it's safer to do it like this. So this is my cartoon of the Hymenoptera, where there's sort of three grades, the largely phytophagous sawflies on the left, the parasitoid wasps, and the aculeates, the more advanced ants, bees, and wasps. And without that, the most primitive group are the sawflies, and there are some sawflies which have developed the parasitoid habit. These are sawflies that feed in logs and rotting wood and attack often other sawflies and beetles. And almost certainly from these, one got the radiation, the massive radiation of the parasitica, an informal grade rather than a proper taxon. And from the parasitica, the aculeates, which contains most of the ants, bees and wasps that non-specialists are familiar with, a much smaller group numerically, but of immense importance both economically and ecologically. And some of the more, less derived aculeates are also parasitoids. But largely, most of the parasitoids are in this big lot in the middle. How many species of parasitoids are there? Well, as I'm sure all of you know, this is very unclear how many insect species there are, far less how many components. And I suppose most people would argue that there'd be somewhere between 250,000 and 2,000,000, with, I guess, most people arguing around 750,000 to 1,000,000. So that's where parasitoids fit into within the Hymenoptera. Now, during the talk, I'm going to be describing different life, a lot of different natural histories of parasitoids. The next slide just gives you an overall picture of some of the diversity. I've put up here four different types of parasitoids attacking different host stages. The eggs of many insects, especially bugs and caterpillars and moths, are attacked by tiny little wasps in the family Scelionidae and Trichogrammidae, one of which can develop per host. Many parasitoids attack the larvae, probably the numerically most important. Some attack the larvae and then develop in later stages. Some attack the egg and then develop from the larvae. But this is a fairly standard, I think this is a Diadegma, an ichneumonid, attacking the larvae underneath here. Here we have a pretty little Terra mallard wasp attacking a pupae of a housefly or a filthfly or something like that. Relatively few parasitoids attack adults. There are quite a few parasitoid flies that do, rather less parasitoid wasps, one or two that attack beetles in particular do. But here I've put an aphidius, one of the economically very important small braconids that attack aphids, and they attack nymphs, and some species also specialize on the adults. So this is just a single slide to sum up a huge diversity, and I'll talk more about the diversity of parasitoids as we go through. So given the huge diversity of parasitoids, and given how important they've been for many aspects of ecology and evolution, I had some difficulty in how I was going to organize this talk. And the way I've decided to do it is to sort of begin with a single female parasitoid looking for a host, and then go through the parasitoid life cycle, what it does when it finds a host, how the larvae develops in the host, and then finally go from the individual parasitoid to the population and then the community. So let's start off with that individual parasitoid that's searching for a host. And the problem the parasitoid has, it's a very, very small insect searching typically for another very, very small insect in an immensely complex habitat. And so unsurprisingly, different parasitoids have evolved a vast panoply of different ways of locating their hosts. And one of the real impressive things of parasitoid behavioral physiologists and behavioral ecologists over the last 70 or 80 years is how they've worked out many of these intricate mechanisms. Now, parasitoids essentially live in a chemical world. Many, many of the cues that they use to locate their hosts are chemical. Frequently, they use a hierarchy of cues. They use cues from the host microhabitat, which gets them in the right place. They then use cues associated with the host, for example, cues associated with the larval frass. And finally, they'll try and use cues associated with the host itself. But the way to think about this interaction is very much that of chemical espionage and countermeasures. The host is trying to adopt the chemical equivalent of radio silence, producing as few cues as possible for the parasitoid to hone into, whereas the parasitoid over evolutionary time is trying to niggle away at any chink in the defenses of the host, to use any cue that's associated with it. And as we've learned increasingly in the past 20 years, these aren't hardwired behaviors that the parasitoid has. They're very flexible behaviors which are learned and are improved as the organism lives its life. So as I said, the parasitoid is largely chemical, but it uses other cues as well. uses visual cues. For example, the parasitoids of leaf miners are able to detect the pattern left in the leaf by the workings of the host. And fly parasitoids in particular use a whole panoply of interesting visual cues. Many parasitoids can detect the vibration of their host, especially those that live in concealed habitats. And much less common, but still used by some, is they can detect heat, the very slight changes in temperature made by a host in a concealed habitat, or sound. And I won't talk about this in any detail because they're not wasps, but there's some fascinating work that's come out recently about how tachinid flies and sarcophagid flies locate calling grasshoppers, which they use as their host. And in order to locate something by sound, your ears have to be sufficiently far apart that you can zero in. And people couldn't work out how flies could do this because their ears are so close together. There's a paper in Nature earlier this year showing how it worked and actually saying that there might be relevance to the design of certain directional microphones as well. So as I said, there's been this massive amount of research on host location. I want to focus in on a current contentious issue at the moment, which is particularly fascinating. And this is that the parasitoid may get help from the plant. This insect here is Micropetus crocipes, which is studied by a number of groups, including Ted Turling's group at Neuchâtel. And Ted, working in Switzerland and before that at USDA in the States, has shown that when its host, in this case a Spodoptera, feeds upon maize, the host plant, the plant suddenly releases a whole load of volatile chemicals. Now, you might think, well, that just happens if you're fed upon, then you accidentally release chemicals. But it doesn't seem to be like that. There's one particular elicitor in the saliva of the caterpillar, something called N17-hydroxylenolinol N-glutamine, and that's a name which I'd like you to believe that I carry around with me and I didn't mug up this morning just to impress you. This one particular chemical causes the plant to release this huge spectrum of different, chiefly volatile terpenoids, which the parasitoid uses to home in on. And it's not a passive release of chemicals. New pathways are switched on. And it's not just in the neighborhood of the damage that the chemical is released. It's released systemically throughout the plant. And the parasitoid uses these chemicals as a means of finding its host. Now, the question is this just something random that the plant has done, that the parasitoid has evolved to utilize, to sort of eavesdrop on something else that's happening? Or do we have direct selection on a tritrophic interaction where the plant is making a pact with its enemy's enemy? Well, this is still an open question at the moment, but there's some recent data which, at least to my mind, is beginning to suggest that this may be an evolved effect, an evolved reaction. This is work done by Jim Tumlinson and Joe Lewis's labs. Consuelo de Moraes is the lead author on it. And it involves this insect here, Cardiocolis. And Cardiocolis is a parasitoid of Heliothus viricens on cotton. But cotton is attacked by several main pests, including Helicobertha zea. So these are two quite closely related. In fact, they're in the same genus until someone in this museum split the genus about 10 years ago. So they're two really quite closely related hosts. But Cardiocolis can only develop on Heliothus viricens and not on... This is here searching for its host there, Heliothus viricens. And what Consuelo de Moraes' group found was that when the cotton plant is attacked by one herbivore, it produces a subtly different blend of terpenoids than when it's attacked by a different herbivore. And the parasitoid is able to detect the terpenoid blend that comes from its host, and it ignores the terpenoid blend that comes from the other host. Moreover, the same thing happens not only on cotton, but on tobacco and grass as well, and maize as well, three different families. Now, one can still say, well, this is just something that has evolved by happenstance, that the parasitoid is making use of volatiles released by the plants for some other purposes. But at least to my opinion, it's getting near to some really quite good evidence that we have an evolved tritrophic interaction. And there's some data in a totally different system of predatory mites and herbivorous mites in plants, which again suggests that this might be happening. And I think this is going to be one of the fascinating areas to watch in chemical ecology in the next few years. Okay, so let's go one stage further. You sort of found out where the host is, and you've now got to get at the host. And this lovely picture that Donald Quick gave me is of a Reconicoid Eurobrachon yochimi from Asia, which is feeding on, whose larvae will feed on a Cerambycid beetle way in the trunk here. If you can, it's hard to see unless you're really close up, but that's the ovipositor sticking out like that. So the ovipositor is 3 or 4 times longer than the host. And there are a number of interesting questions here. And the first one is a straight biomechanical question. How can this really little ovipositor, how can it drill all the way through to find the host? And Donald has done some fascinating work on this, showing exactly how the two parts of the, how the ovipositor can act as a brace for itself and can, just by very small movements at the end of the ovipositor, it can just push its way between the different fibres of the wood. But something else that Donald has found recently is that the ovipositor, which is made of chitin, is reinforced by heavy metals. And these heavy metals depend on the species that you look at, but typically are zinc and manganese. And what Donald argues is that there is a heavy metal economy in these insects. The hosts of the insects require these heavy metals in order to strengthen their mandibles, which they need not only to eat their way through the wood, but also to emerge. And then the parasitoids have evolved to become immensely efficient and getting every bit of heavy metal out of their host in order that they can incorporate it into their own structures. And there are some also interesting phylogenetic effects as well. This is a proper phylogeny, as it's been done by someone from the museum rather than by me, of a group of parasitoids, all of which have these long ovipositors. And as you can see, certain groups use zinc, certain groups use manganese, etc. And it's going to be a fascinating project to discover under why one uses one heavy metal and one the other. Is it phylogenetic inertia? Is it due to the host? How does the ecology and the phylogeny interact in order to determine exactly the strategy, the morphological strategy used by the wasp? Okay, so continuing our way through this amalgam of parasitoid life cycles, we're now at the stage where we've found the host. And I want to concentrate briefly on the questions facing those wasps that are gregarious. That is those wasps in which more than one larvae develop together on the same host. And this is an example of such... I'm sorry, I need to go back. This is an example of such a one, Goniosus nephantidus, a bathylid, which lays a series of little eggs on the outside of a caterpillar, and these are the larvae which have developed from the clutch of the eggs. This is also a fascinating parasitoid because the mother here remains with the host as her larvae develops and protects them from superparasitism and from multiparasitism, that is by attack by parasitoids of the same or a different species. Now, clutch size is one of the classic problems in behavioral ecology. One of the major aspects of the life history of any organism is whether you produce your young singly or in groups and of how big. And this has been traditionally studied in birds for many years, and David Lack is perhaps the most famous name associated with that. And one thing typically what the ornithologists do is they look for trends of clutch size with external factors such as food supply, latitude, and then they do manipulation experiments. They see what happens when you force a bird to rear a clutch that is smaller or larger than it would have done otherwise. Now, one thing that we did some years ago was to just pretend this was a typical great tit or blue tit, the type of bird you do this type of experiment on, and we observed, and we asked, first of all, does the animal change its clutch size as you change the resources, in this case, the size of the larvae? And then we did some manipulation experiments. And we found some, what we thought were some interesting results. First of all, the parasitoid has exquisite control over clutch size. You give it a slightly larger host, and it produces a proportionately larger clutch size. Other people have done this work on other things as well. The parasitoids have wonderful abilities to detect the size of the host and to essentially do really quite sophisticated family planning. The second thing we did was to manipulate the clutch size. Now, if you do this in birds and you say give a great tit with typical clutch size, I don't know, 8 or 9, 2 or 3 extra chicks, then what tends to happen is mortality goes up. That doesn't happen with parasitoids. Mortality stays about the same, but what happens is that the size of the the size of the parasitoid that emerges as an adult is smaller than if the clutch had been the typical size that the mother would have laid. So you get a smaller wasp such as this. And if you then try and estimate fitness as a function of size, you find that these smaller wasps do poorly. So we have a qualitative argument about the selection pressures acting on clutch size. We tried to go one further and make that quantitative. And when we tried to do that, when we tried to actually work out the fitness that would the clutch size that would maximize the fitness of the wasp, we tended to overestimate it. And what we learned from that is a sort of inverse optimality approach, is that we were underestimating the importance of size for fitness. And in essence, we were trying to estimate the importance of size for fitness in the lab, and what one needs to do that is to work in the field. Unfortunately, this animal here, it attacks Ecophorid moss on the top of coconut trees in Sri Lanka. So it's a lovely place to work, but not a great one to do large-scale experiments. But what we've been doing at Silwood Park is using different organisms, is really trying to get at the effect of size on fitness in the field, which is a difficult thing to do, and you tend to do it by having to compare statistically the size distribution of emerging wasps and those caught in the act of mating or oviposition. So the point I want to make from this work in goniosis is that you can apply some of the standard techniques in behavioral ecology to investigate the life history of this organism. But in a sense, that's just applying what's been done to other things to parasitoids. With clutch size and parasitoids, there are a couple of unique features which you can't do in other organisms, or virtually not do in other organisms, which I think informs the broader subject. Now, I've talked so far about gregarious wasps, but you can divide parasitoids into solitary and gregarious individuals. Gregarious have a range of clutch size. Solitary wasps are always solitary. Only a single individual ever develops. And the reason for this is that the larvae of solitary wasps, but not gregarious, have these whopping great mandibles, and they fight among themselves until only one remains. And this was discovered and worked on by the great George Salt at Cambridge, who single-handedly invented the subject of parasitoid physiology. And I've been trying to get a slide of George Salt for a couple of years now, and William Foster at Cambridge had a look for me and failed, and he said, well, everyone says he looked a spitting image as a young man of the Emperor Hirohito. So anyway, here's the Emperor Hirohito, which hopefully will give you some idea. So what we have is, notice that the mandibles on these wasps, they're a trait that are expressed in the larvae, whereas clutch size is a trait that's expressed in the parent. To understand this problem of how clutch size can evolve and the transition between gregariousness and solitariness, one needs to simultaneously look at how selection will operate on offspring and on parents. And this is a field of parent-offspring conflict in evolutionary theory. And it's a field that there's a lot of speculation, but relatively little data, and relatively little hard predictions about how things occur. Now, I'm going to give you none of the details beyond to say, What we have done is we've tried to model, using explicitly genetic models, how natural selection will operate on genes expressed in the young and in the parent. And I want to imagine that we have a host that over evolutionary time increases in size or decreases in size, and will index the worth of the host by the optimum clutch size for the parent. So if it's big, then the parent wants to lay more eggs. If it's small, it wants to lay a fewer number of eggs. You could also think of this as a parasitoid switching between hosts of different size. So here we have a solitary larvae with the fighting mandibles. Here we have this is the common Catheta glomeratus on cabbage moss emerging, and they don't have these fighting mandibles. Now imagine we start off with a female producing a large number of eggs on a large host. And over evolutionary time, the host gets smaller and smaller. What we predict is that it isn't a straight continuum going all the way down to one, a constant spectrum. This parent-offspring conflict leads to a jump here from a clutch size of about 3, then you go solitary. Now, if you go in the other direction, you start off with a solitary individual here, and you go all the way up here, and you remain solitary. So even though the host is big enough that the parent, speaking teleologically, would like to lay 14 or 15 eggs, selection operating on the young, parent-offspring conflict, prevents this from being realized, and one doesn't get the switch to gregariousness until there. So this is unusual, and it shows a number of things. First of all, it shows evolutionary hysteresis. The change between solitariness and gregariousness depends upon the direction from which you approach it. And also, it shows that the solitary state is an absorbing state. Paul Harvey, in writing a commentary on this, referred to it as a black hole. At least I think he was referring to the science and not to my research, is it? But once you get to this absorbing state here, it is hard to get out again. So what's the data for this? Well, Andy Le Mesurier, then a student of Jeff Waage, surveyed all the clutch size and host size of microgastrines in what was then the genus of Apanteles, is now a cluster of genera, including Catesia. And he discovered two things, and he did it in a reasonably sophisticated way, looking at volume rather than just numbers. Although in those days, this was 15 years ago, he didn't formally control for phylogeny, and it'd be fascinating to do it again doing that. And he found that there were many hosts of this size that were either attacked by a wasp that laid a clutch size of 8, 9, or 10, or solitary ones. And he also found that there was an absence of gregarious parasitoids with a clutch size of the order of 2 or 3. Now, as I say, that work needs to be redone using modern comparative methods, but I think it's some argument that there's something fascinating going on here. And again, this is something where I'd like to argue that looking at the natural history of the parasitoid tells us something general about an important topic in evolutionary theory, such as parent-offspring conflict. Another thing that is not quite unique to parasitoids, but reaches its greater development within the parasitoid wasps, is polyembryony. This little insect here is Capitosonum floridanum, and it's laying its egg, either one or two eggs, into the egg of its host, which is Trichoplusia or Pseudoplusia, one of the Plusiad noctuids. So it lays its eggs into the egg of its host. And then the pupae don't actually emerge until the host has grown to a large caterpillar. But in this time, the parasitoid eggs, it gets a bit confusing talking about parasitoid eggs and host eggs, so I hope this is making sense. The parasitoid egg divides asexually many, many times to produce this large polyembryonic broods of genetically identical individuals. And so I'll talk about this in a little more detail in a second, but here we get the series of divisions. They then differentiate into larvae, and finally, when the Plusiad is virtually full-grown, the larvae pupate, and these little lozenges here are individual pupae. And I think the world record for the clutch size of one of these capitosomas is of the order of 4,000. And a typical clutch size in one of these big hosts is 400 or 500. Now, one of the weird things that happens is that you get two morphs of larvae. You get the normal morph here, which grows up and becomes a wasp, and you get these rather faster developing precocious morphs here, which never develop into a final, an adult wasp. So why does this occur? This is a larger picture of the precocious morph, and they're the two things here. This is Mike Strand, who's done the most important recent work on this. I should say that these things were discovered by Silvestri, the great Italian entomologist around the turn of the century, and rediscovered by Yolanda Cruz about 20 years ago. And Cruz argued that what these things did was they defended their siblings from other parasitoids, in particular multi-parasitoids. Parasitoids of different species. And last year, Mike Strand's group published a really neat paper showing that if you had a Pleusiad host that was attacked by one of these things, and you then caused it to be attacked by yet another wasp, an ichneumonid this time, then the capitosoma responded by producing more of these different of these precocious larvae. But it's more complicated than that. I said at the beginning that the wasp either lays one or two eggs into the host. Now, everything I've said so far really applies to the case when the wasp lays one egg and the 400-500 different wasps that develop are genetically identical individuals. But when the wasp lays two eggs, what happens is that one is a male and one is a female. Now, for a reason I'm going to talk about in a moment, when this happens, you expect there to be a female bias sex ratio coming out. And again, for reasons I'll describe in a moment. And what seems to happen is that this female bias sex ratio occurs because female precocious larvae attack and kill male precocious larvae. And we don't really understand yet what's going there, but there's something very complicated that's going on. The number and distribution of these precocious larvae is determined partly by defense and partly by this sibling rivalry. It's an effect that's analogous to some of the parent-offspring conflict things I've just said about. Closely related individuals, but with subject to subtly different selection pressures, giving rise to these complex behaviors. And so again, this is something where I think that parasitoid wasps are saying something much more general. I'm not an embryologist and a developmentalist, but Mike Strand has also argued that capitosomans are an excellent model for exploring some of the issues in early development, where you get two radically different morphs developing in the same milieu when they're genetically identical. Okay, so we've found the host, we've decided what clutch to lay. Another decision we have to make at that time is what sex to lay. And it's probably in the field of sex ratio theory, again, a major preoccupation of evolutionists, that work on parasitoids has had the greatest impression. Darwin famously said that why 50-50 sex ratios were so common was a problem to be left to a future generation. And this was taken up by Sir Ronald Fisher in the 1920s and 30s, who argued that if the name of the game in evolution is to get your genes into future generations, then the only stable way, the only time when selection will stop biasing the sex ratio is when there's a 50-50 sex ratio. If the sex is biased towards males, okay, so males are common, then females are relatively more valuable and you switch your sex ratio. If males are relatively rare, then males are more valuable, so you switch your sex ratio and a 50-50 sex ratio evolves. But the great Bill Hamilton, who I know many of you will know and was a great friend of the museum, who died tragically young very recently, he pointed out in 1967 that this argument assumed complete mixing of the population, panmixia in the genetic term. And if there was a greater probability that your sons will mate with your daughters, a greater than random probability, then it was more efficient to bias your sex ratio towards females. You didn't want to make your sons compete with each other, compete with their brothers. That was less efficient compared with the case when you have panmixia. And so Bill invented the theory of local mate competition, which says that as the number of mothers mating in one place, whose sons and daughters compete within the same arena for mating, as that decreases from a large number, the assumption of panmixia, when you get a 50-50 sex ratio, the sex ratio becomes more female biased as the number of mothers goes down. And essentially, when you have only two or three females producing offspring who mate among themselves, then you get really quite a strongly female biased sex ratio. And in his classic paper in Science in 1967, Bill invented the word the biofacies of extreme inbreeding, which no one ever uses except when they quote Bill on this. And he gave examples of where you got this extreme inbreeding associated with a female biased sex ratio. And I think of the 24 examples he gave, about 19 of them were parasitoid wasps or fig wasps. But Jack Warren, who's here, this is a photo taken at Down House, and there's Darwin again there. Jack Warren was the first person who did a series of experiments. And Jack is a great naturalist, and he worked with Nazonia vitrepenis, a pteromallid that is a parasitoid of a variety of Cyclorhamphus and Diptera, filth flies, house flies, etc. And he studied in particular, and Nazonia is quite prolificus, and he compared the sex ratio of Nazonia when they were in sort of large dumps with hundreds of flies and wasps ovipositing together, where you'd expect to get panmixia, with what happens in birds' nests. And each bird's nest is only probably colonized by a couple of wasps. And exactly as Bill had predicted, you got more female biased sex ratios in birds' nests, where there's local mate competition, than in rubbish dumps, where essentially you get panmixia. He did neat laboratory experiments, where he placed females singly in small groups and large groups. And again, these wasps behaved as Bill predicted. Then a more technical comparison is that if you have a second wasp coming along and laying a clutch of eggs in a pupae, then if you adapt Bill's equations to that case, this is superparasitism, you predict that the second wasp should lay a very male biased sex ratio. Essentially, the argument's the same, but it's more complex, and that's exactly what Nazonia does. So work with Nazonia and with a whole suite of other wasps has shown that Hamilton's theory of local mate competition really is quite accurate. And I could essentially give a whole lecture on different theories of how sex ratios are biased, and many of the work which shows that these situations do work in nature has been done with parasitoids. But rather than do that, I want to mention really an exception. The reason why Fisher's theory of sex ratio is so general is that in virtually every organism, there's a trade-off between laying males and females. You either lay a male or a female. Now, this may be determined by sex chromosomes and proximate sex determination factors, but over a long-term evolutionary time, natural selection can work on the trade-off. This is Encarsia pagandiella, a little aphelinid. And aphelinids have a really weird biology, or at least some of them do. A group of aphelinids, heteronymous aphelinids, males and females develop in different ways. In the most extreme case, one sex develops as a parasitoid of Lepidopteran eggs, one develops as a parasitoid of Homopteran. In other cases, males develop as hyperparasitoids, females develop as primary parasitoids. Now, suppose that you have a wasp whose reproductive success is limited by the number of eggs it has. So it can choose whether to lay in a male-appropriate or a female-appropriate host, but it's limited by the number of eggs. Well, we have the straight Fisherian system. They should produce a 50-50 sex ratio, as Fisher predicted. But if they're not limited by the number of eggs, but they're limited by the opportunities to lay eggs, they're limited by hosts, then we have broken the trade-off between males and females. And there the sex ratio should be determined purely by the frequency of hosts of the correct type. And Molly Hunter, who lent me this slide, and as well as a number of other people, especially Gimme Walter, have shown that this is precisely what happens. And I believe that this is an almost unique test of sex ratio theory. There is a family of stylopods that I know virtually nothing about that I think does the same thing. But again, I think this is an exception, which again shows how parasitoid natural history can illuminate an interesting question in evolutionary biology. But let me just go back to Nazonia. When Jack Warren was doing these experiments on local mate competition to try and explore Hamilton's theory, he tried to select for sex ratio in Nazonia. And he got some bizarre results. And to cut a long story short, he found that segregating in the population was a variety of elements that biased the sex ratios. Something I meant to say earlier and forgot is why Hymenoptera in general and parasitoids in particular are particularly amenable to sex ratio study is that they have a haploid-diploid genetic system. Males are haploid, females are diploid. The female can determine the sex of her young by choosing whether to fertilize the egg or not. Now, PSR, they didn't know it at the time, has turned out to be an aberrant B chromosome that can really only effectively get into the next generation through the sperm. Curious things happen in producing a female egg, which weeds out B chromosomes, but they can get into the sperm. So what PSR does, this rogue B chromosome, one of the most selfish elements known to evolutionary biology, is when it finds itself in a female, it destroys the paternally derived chromosome copy. And so you convert a diploid embryo to a haploid embryo, you convert a female into a male, and so it can get into the next generation. These two things can only get through in the female, and they do the reverse. We don't know what maternal sex ratio, MSR, is, but we know it can only get through in the maternal line, and if it finds itself in a male, it destroys the male egg. Sunkiller, the rather non-euphoniously named bacteria Arsenophonus nazonii, works in Nazonia, and it causes suns to die. So imagine you've got a clutch of eggs within the pupae of a fly, all the suns die, and this gives a marginal advantage to the females that carry them. So this whole zoo turned up in Nazonia when it was looked at. And not only does Nazonia have these things, it has Wolbachia. Now, Wolbachia is an intracellular bacteria that yet again can only get into the next generation through females. It's been known for a long time, originally I think in mosquitoes, and it was discovered in Nazonia in the 60s. But Jack Warren again found it to be relatively common in parasitoids. I think he's found about 15 to 20% of all parasitoids he's looked at have it. And that figure applies to many other organisms as well. So how does Wolbachia spread in parasitoids? This is a picture of it here. These rather mitochondria-looking things are the Wolbachia. Well, it does it in two ways. Remember, it needs to be in a female. In Trichogramma and in quite a few aphelinids, what it does is if it finds itself in a male, it causes the chromosome number to double, and so it converts the individual into a female. But it also does something really very sneaky as well. When it doesn't do that, what it does is if it finds itself in a female, it will only accept sperm from a male that is infected by Wolbachia. So this means that relative to uninfected individuals, any male that doesn't have this password that Wolbachia gives it is at a disadvantage. So by this rather indirect way, by disadvantaging non-infected males, it can spread through the population. And one of the growth areas in insect biology at the moment is looking at the many ramifications that this has. In particular, it can cause strain and species incompatibility. And another major issue is we know, both theoretically and by looking at phylogenies, that Wolbachia must, at least to some extent, spread horizontally from host to host. And we don't know how this happens, but one possibility is through parasitoids. And there's some conflicting evidence at the moment about the extent to which this happens. Okay, so we've now laid our egg in the host, and we now have to battle the host immune defences. We can do this in two ways. we can knock out the host at oviposition, or alternatively, we can live with it, at least for a little bit. And we have to live with it sometimes when the egg is laid in such a small host, there isn't enough resources to develop. For example, the capitosoma, the parasitoid egg is laid in the host egg, and it's got to put up with the host defences until it's big enough to have enough food to feed. This is a parasitoid that does it. It's Azabara tarbida that attacks Drosophila. And it seems to get away from the immune defences of the host by having a sticky egg that hides in the fat body. Now, one of the things that Mark Fellows, Lex Kreivold and I have been exploring is the evolution of resistance to parasitoids and also the evolution of countermeasures to parasitoids. And one thing we've done is we've taken lines of Drosophila, and we have control lines, and we've selected them by subjecting them to really high levels of parasitism and only breeding from those hosts that have escaped parasitism. And this is a typical result here. You get a very strong response to selection, from about 0.4% up to about 40%. So why doesn't this occur in nature? Well, we found that not only that there is a strong response, but there is a cost to being better able to resist your parasitoids. It turns out that if you're better able to resist your parasitoids, you're a poorer larval competitor. And we think we know why. What we think happens during the selection period is that the animal, over a number of generations, switches a limiting resources from a trophic function, how fast it feeds, to produce more immune cells, more defense cells. And we suspect that because it's feeding less faster, then it's okay when conditions are great, but under times of resource stress, then it does badly. And we're currently exploring what happens when you select parasitoids to have stronger counter resistance. But again, this is one of the main things we're trying to do at the moment in my lab, is to use hosts and parasitoids as a model system to explore these co-evolutionary interactions. And having spent, I suppose, the first 15 years of my career trying to avoid working on Drosophila, I have to admit that they are a pretty neat thing with which to work. One of the things we're also interested in is how things like this feed into the population dynamics. And studies on parasitoid population dynamics have really been at the forefront of developing modern quantitative ecology. The first real quantitative equations for studying what happens in a consumer resource system in discrete times were developed by two Australian scientists in the early 30s, Nicholson and Bailey, and George Varley and Mike Castle have been responsible for much of the modern development of this. The two pictures showing the decline in professorial sartorial standards over the last 30 years as well. All the Nicholson-Bailey model has is essentially, it assumes random searching, and you have searching efficiency of the parasitoid and fecundity of the host. And the most important feature that Nicholson-Bailey tells us is this sort of model of a host-parasitoid interaction is really resolutely unstable. If life is as simple as this, then we wouldn't expect to see any parasitoids. And what research has followed over the last 30 or 40 years is twofold. First of all, to try and understand why host-parasitoid interactions persist. And secondly, to try and take simple models like this and to apply them specifically to real organisms. And I'm going to give two examples of that. One of the disadvantages of applying things to real organisms is that models get much, much complex. But one shouldn't be put off or frightened by that as long as the complexity is dictated by the natural history. And this is work that John Liu, a student of mine, has been doing with a group in Liverpool who have been studying long-term population dynamics of venturia and stored product pests such as Zephistia. And what they've shown is that you get some really quite fascinating population dynamics. This is a model output, but it matches some of the long-term dynamics they get, where you get either these long-term transients. So you have this behavior there, which goes on for about 2 years and then switches to something else, to a different pattern there. Or you get alternative stable states, so how you put the community together depends on how you construct them. And doing models such as this can help understand how that works out. And so that's the case of trying to tailor these models to laboratory experiments. Bill Murdoch's group in the States had done some wonderful joint modeling and experimental work trying to work out why this little thing here, Aphetus malinus, has been so successful in controlling citrus red scale. This is the red scale on citrus here. So it's a very successful biocontrol introduction. But why were the populations so stable? And they've, as I said, they've done this combination of field experiments and modeling. Here's some of the field experiments that they've done. And they've shown that the stability doesn't come from spatial processes, but is local processes, and seems to be a combination of the refuges in the system, some physical, some caused by the fact that the adult scales themselves are not susceptible to parasitism, combined with a very fast numerical response by the parasitoid. By the parasitoid here. Parasitoid can increase in numbers very quickly. And so I know that some people don't like mathematics and ecology and things, but I think if you're really a naturalist and you really want to understand how what you intuitively understand as natural history carries through to the population dynamics, then you've got no alternative but to try it. So in a different context, John Maynard Smith, evolutionary genetics, saying if you don't like the mathematics, keep out of the evolutionary kitchen. And I fear the same applies for if you care about population dynamics and applied pest management. And while I'm on pest management, I'd just like to say, and again, this is something very familiar to everyone, just how valuable parasitoids have been in biological control, where parasitoids have been introduced to attack major pests. This is Epidinocarcis lopezi. I'm not quite certain if this name is correct. John Noyes changed it to Apa anagyrus. In a bar in Brazil, he told me he was about to change it back to Epidinocarcis. So I've put it like that, but I'm not sure if that's correct or not. This is a famous biological control. The cassava mealybug in the, I think it's late 70s, early 80s, it went through the whole of Africa, caused really severe reductions in yield. And I give this example now because a group called led by Zeddes has recently done what I think is one of the most accurate economic analyses of this, a real proper economic analysis, looking at taking into account indirect costs, doing the proper devaluation into the future. And they estimate that the cost of this continent-wide biocontrol campaign was £47 million, and that the benefits, well, are somewhere between 9 and 20 billion. That variability depends on what you assume would have happened if biocontrol hadn't existed. In particular, whether they import more cassava, whether they switch to growing maize, import maize. So there are some major uncertainties there. But the cost-benefit ratio, which actually matters to economists, calculated in the tip, I keep firing my laser at Dick, I hope I haven't blinded him. Is it somewhere and discounted over 40 years, exactly as you would do a bit of agroforestry or a main building, is somewhere in the order of 200 to 430. So really just a wonderful argument for biological control when it works. My final two slides are just to mention some things that we're interested in at the moment. The population dynamics I've shown you so far are the classic case of one host attacking one parasitoid. But we know that nature is much more complicated than that. And over the last 10 years, my group has been collecting quantitative parasitoid food webs. And we've been doing this both in the UK and in the tropics. And in the tropics, these have always been, we've had two major projects, which have been collaborative projects with people in the museum, for which I'm just immensely grateful. We couldn't have approached the diversity of wasps without the help here. This is an example of one we're working on in the UK. This is essentially a gestalt slide more than anything detail. These are aphids along the bottom there with relative abundance, primary parasitoids along here, and here the hyperparasitoids up there. And these, why we think that this is a good way of looking at it is that these are quantitative food webs which allow us to make quantitative inferences about community structure and about how one species may interact with another. These are the natural picture of the bugs we're working on. Here's an aphidius attacking an aphid, and here we have some aphids from which they've moved out. So complex communities are the rule. We're interested in two particular aspects here. We're trying to build up a database of communities all studied in exactly the same way, which we can then try and compare to try and deduce features about what structure in their communities. And secondly, we're interested about how two hosts can interact via shared natural enemies. So imagine two hosts on different food plants, they can still interact via their shared parasitoids. And the web that I've just shown you, which is collected by Christine Muller and Frank van Veen, here is an example of what I've assumed here. These are the different aphids represented by the vertices of these graphs. And if the aphids share parasitoids, they are linked by these lines here. So we can begin to assess the potential for these indirect effects for apparent competition. And I haven't had time to go through them, but based on this information, we can go out and design experiments to try and see whether that apparent competition exists in the field. And our work has been largely field-based using this aphid community. I should mention some really nice work done recently by Mike Bonsall and Mike Hassel, working with a laboratory system, in fact, the same system that I showed you the complex model of, where they've shown exactly how two hosts can interact via the shared natural enemy, this thing that I've called apparent competition. Just to finish off with, I can't resist just one comment. The web I've shown you here, many of the hyperparasitoids up here are these really cute Alexistine wasps. And we've been trying to explore the diversity of these Alexistine wasps. And despite some heroic work by Nigel Ferguson 15 years ago in trying to sort out some of the taxonomic problems, we found that they are immensely diverse, much more diverse than expected. And we've done this by combinations. Frank van Veen, who's led this, done this by a combination of traditional morphology and trying to back some of that up by molecular work. And I just wanted to finish up to say something very briefly about systematics, something which I know nothing about, so I realise that this is a dangerous thing to say. I put up three people here. One is the famous Francis Walker, who worked in the museum in the last century and described huge numbers of species. He was particularly fond of some parasitoids, one in particular, which is a parasitoid of leaf mine, as I know well, Nagelio longipectinicornis, a really pretty parasitoid, which he found so pretty he gave it no less than 17 different names. I don't know if this is true. There's a rumour that he was paid by the number of parasitoid species that he described. And I think if you look very carefully at the Hague's manifesto, that there may be something in there about the same incentives for the modern museum. But Marcus de Vere Graham, who worked at Oxford, largely spent his life trying to sort out some of the mess that Walker produced. And Jenik Bocek, who worked in this museum for CABI, has also done a huge amount. And we would like to try and sort out some of these problems, but we are just completely up against, in essence, the vestige of the first bioinformatics revolution. The first bioinformatics revolution during the last century, when people became aware of the diversity of organisms and invented a system for coping with it. And we see that system in the way that species are described by the zoological codes and things like that. And this is such a dead weight on modern systematics, so much so that we don't have names for many British eumonids because people just don't want to spend their career sorting out the taxonomic confusion. That's a legacy of the last century. So I just have a plea, given I've got a captive audience of taxonomists here for the moment. I suppose to speak about systematics, I should learn how to say it a bit more fluently. For a sort of second revolution in bioinformatics, taking a leaf out of the bioinformatics from the molecular side, something that would be much more web-based. And I really do think the museum is in the vanguard in this. If you look at the museum website and see what you're doing with, say, echinoderms and bumblebees and things, that really is a fascinating use of new technology. Now, this isn't a substitute for new resources. Clearly, more resources need to go into systematics. But I think it's going to be easier to get those new resources if one really has a revolution in how one treats what's essentially a bioinformatics problem. So I finished just with a parasitoid and by coming back to Darwin. Darwin did go through periods when he was really quite morose, and contemplating parasitoids did tend to bring on flights of moroseness. And he finishes his letter to Asa Gray by talking about, is there a beneficent God and things? And he says, he essentially gives up. He says, a dog might as well speculate on the mind of Newton. And it's something which I think is just a wonderfully poignant phrase, let each man hope and believe what he can. Well, if the shade of Darwin is up there, and it's a grandiloquent thing to expect him to be listening to this lecture, but if he is, I hope that he's been convinced that the ichneumonids he so much hated really do back up his theory of evolution. Thank you.
Well, Charles, thank you so much for an absolutely marvellous lecture. Elegant, revealing, exciting, and eventually challenging, not least to our own community here. Charles, we didn't get a chance to ask beforehand whether you'd be prepared to answer one or two questions.
As long as they're not about the systematics bit.
Are there questions out there? I've got one I'll jump in with straight off, which is an easy one, I'm sure. Awful lot of parasitoids seem to have, at least hymenopteran ones, to my limited knowledge, seem to have white bands on the antennae or tips and so on. I heard a suggestion 20 years ago this was something to do with being able to assess host size. Is there anything in that? Because you referred clearly to the fact that they can assess host size. How do they do it?
Donald. I think that...
A long time ago, I wrote a paper on this.
That was you. I thought it was.
there's a little bit of evidence that one which attacks Zygainids measures along the size of a Zygainid cocoon with its antenna, and maybe because the antenna got many segments, it's easy to just see how far the white stripes are separated to get a gauge.
So why do they have them on the ovipositor as well?
I wrote a paper on that as well.
I'm the sort of feed.
Any other questions? Is that John? Yeah, John.
Yeah, specifically because Charles said not to ask anyone about systematics, not to ask anyone about systematics. It's really, how do we encourage people out there, especially amateur entomologists, how do we encourage them to become interested in identifying parasitic wasps? If you look at things like humans are lepidoptera, there are hundreds in the country. If you look at parasitic wasps, you probably have not more than 30.
Quite seriously, John, the last thing I want to do is to stand up here and lecture you guys on systematics. But if I was forced to say something, then I really do think the way to do it is through the web. Many of the people here who are entomologists started off by collecting butterflies and moths and then got into it. In a way, that's frankly, and I think largely rightly, not acceptable today. And people are going to go out there today, not with nets, but with digital cameras, which are coming down cheap enough for people to have. They're going to get into the web. One of the things that I'm absolutely delighted that Dick has led on with the museum and the Cocaine Trust is to produce a site which will have all the British macros up on the web and soon the micros as well. I think that will get people into the web. Now, that's LEPS, but once they're on the webs and things like that, it then needs to get into doing the other things. I'd like to see the International Society of Hymenopterists setting up committees for each of the main families that will run websites devoted to each of those families so that in time, one, all the described species and things will be on the web, and that there will be committees that look after them exactly as there are committees that look after the different components of Flybase, the different annotation things. I think once it's up on the web and accessible, then you're going to get people in it. Moreover, I think it's going to be a more attractive subject to fund when it can shake off this... I think one should be proud of the first bioinformatics revolution, whatever, exactly what the 19th century entomologists did in systematists in general, in organising that amount of information. But it's... I think it's going to happen by revolution rather than by evolution.
One question here. It's going to have to be brief, I'm afraid.
I think some of the co-evolutionary implications of host-parasite interactions are particularly fascinating. You've shown, in a sense, you can select hosts for resistance to parasitoid attack. So the question is the relative contribution of genes and phenotypic plasticity to that sort of response, because you'd think the smart host would be one that had the plasticity to switch between the higher immune response and the features that require for normal development, rather being hardwired as a good resistor or a good developer?
It's a combination of the both. I didn't have time to go into this, but we actually have a part conceptual, part mathematical model of what happens when a host is parasitized. And what happens is that the wasp injects all types of things, toxins. It injects a whole load of viruses. If I had more time, I'd like to have talked about the viruses injected by parasitoids. Just weird and fabulous. But there's a really dynamic interaction that's going on there, and we've learnt just. And one of the things that the byproducts of the tragedy of the HIV pandemic is we really understand the importance of dynamics in infection and immunity and things like that. So I think that what happens after parasitism is immensely dynamic. And if you model this, you don't really need to. You can do it in the back of an envelope. Then the starting values are immensely important. So it's not only the plastic response, but what you have before. And so if you have a large stock of immune cells ready to go, then that gives you the advantage. So in no sense do I want to underestimate the importance of an efficient plastic response, but I think also one has to have there's a role for this genetic response as well.
I'm going to have to draw a halt there, Charles, and... Everybody in the audience, I'm sorry, there's going to be a chance to buttonhole Charles in a few minutes, I hope, if you've got a question you want to pose to him most passionately. Before thanking our speaker again, two things. First, I ought to thank a number of people in the entomology department for work beyond the call of normal duty in helping to set up the lecture, specifically Linda Pitkin, Vanessa Morell, who's not here, Terry Holmes and Janet Kemp, and as you can see, we're wandering into the area of sex ratio difficulties, so I'm very grateful that our projectionist at least is of the male species, as it were. Thank you, Ken, very much for your contributions. Mike Claridge, could you just say very briefly a few words about proceedings at the Society and later?
Yes, well, thank you very much, Dick. But first, let me just say what a wonderful start to the day. Thank you very much for that.
Absolutely.
Wonderful talk. As you know, we've tried to set up jointly with Dick and the Natural History Museum and the Society over the road a sort of day of entomology. It's our annual meeting very shortly over in 41 Queen's Gate. And following that, at about 5 o'clock, we have the second major lecture of the day. And I'm delighted to be taking the chair at that. This is going to be given by Professor Hannelore Hoch from the Humboldt University in Berlin. I know she's here somewhere, I just can't quite there she is at the back. This will be over in our lecture room at 41 Queen's Gate. And I hope many of you will come over to listen to that, and indeed I hope many of you will also come to our annual meeting where there are various other activities and presentation of honorary fellowships and so on. So, in fact, there is tea being served in our library and in the council chamber, for those of you who know 41 Queen's Gate, which will be most of you, from, by the time you get there.
Right.
The annual general meeting starts at 4 o'clock.
Okay. Thanks very much, Mike. Well, there are drinks outside, which you're invited to enjoy a little of before moving on to Queen's Gate. I hope a number of you will transfer over to Queen's Gate, of course. But before doing that, I just want to thank Charles again on my behalf, Mike's behalf, all of our behalfs, for a truly fantastic lecture, truly fitting tribute to Edwards and to Darwin. Thank you so much, Charles. Wonderful. Thank you.